being really smart about, now that we know what the situation is, can we plan for the worst case and really make sure the deal works out? It's in a good location with good neighborhood, can do value add in those properties. So really thinking through that. So that's kind of where my thought process is.
Do you love your job, but want other investment options than your company's 401k and trying to pick stocks? If so, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, you will get actionable information for your passive real estate investment journey. Welcome back to another episode of Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Here's your host, Justin Dixon.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. I am your host, Justin Dixon. And today on the podcast, we have Vivia Smith. She is a multifamily syndicator investor out of Dallas, Texas. And we dive into her career, starting out as an engineer, growing, kind of climbing the corporate ladder and making good money, but really had an interest in kind of figuring out tax strategies so that she can kind of not pay as much in taxes and invest in different asset classes. So she found multifamily real estate about a year and a half ago, started the journey passively. We dive into kind of how she vets operators and people that are finding her deals, which is very important now more than ever in the multifamily world. And then we shift over to talking about her active investing, which she just started earlier this year on a deal in Dallas. So really interesting episode with Divya. So let's get her on the pod. All right, Divya, welcome to the pod. Happy to have you on.
Well, it's so good to be here, Justin. I'm excited to talk to you today.
Awesome. Well, cool. Well, let's kick things off. Why don't you give me and the audience a little bit more of a deep dive overview of who you are and what you're up to in the real estate world?
Sounds awesome. So Justin, I've been in real estate about a year and a half to 2 years. I started out kind of passive investing, then moving into full-time investing. And currently I'm a syndicator. So I basically kind of bring deals together with a group of investors, and we like to invest and partner together in buying large apartment buildings. So that's kind of where I got started. I have about $100 million under assets, which includes both passive and active deals. And I closed on a deal earlier this year, and I'm actually working on a deal right now.
Got it. Well, it sounds like you're active in this environment, which is something I'm very interested to kind of dig into. But I guess I want to kind of start at the beginning of your journey. Did you have a career before you kind of jumped into real estate, or do you currently have a W-2 or another business, or are you full into real estate?
So I'm fully into real estate at this time, but I started out my career as kind of the usual technology professional, started out with programming. I've had 20 years of technology experience. Started out kind of with that thought process of get a good job, get married, have kids. I've kind of followed my checklist life and had been continuing to kind of be promoted in multiple levels of career. And my last role was senior director of technology, and I was running that at United Health Group. So there I had a team, a large team, worked on large initiatives, and at some point in time was just fascinated by the idea of passive investing and then also being able to kind of live a more purposeful and meaningful life and really work on something that I could bring to people and help more people about.
Yeah. So I'm curious about that because obviously if you were a senior director in technology at a large company, you're probably making good money. You're probably working a lot of hours. At what point did the real estate bug kind of creep in? Because, you know, if you grow up in that traditional getting a job, invest in the stock market, invest in the 401k, unless you're exposed to it, real estate really isn't part of that vernacular, if you will. So how did that kind of start for you?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think like the background that we come from, really like real estate doesn't really come up in any conversations. Investing really just doesn't either. The most I'd heard about investing was, hey, like, if you're going to think about investing, get a financial advisor, and that would be the conversation. So for me, kind of that the pivoting moment that I call was I was doing my taxes and kind of realized the amount of money that I'd already paid in taxes. And I still owed, like, I think it was like $20,000 I still owed in taxes.
Yeah.
And kind of take a moment to think about, well, I paid a bunch already. I still got to pay more. And I'm giving away so much of my life working and making this money that I'm basically turning around and giving back.
Right.
So that was really kind of that moment. And I sat down and really started to think about, hey, if I was to calculate my hourly rate based on all the number of hours I've worked, the amount of taxes I've paid, what would I be making? And that number wasn't very good. It was ranging between $50 to $60 an hour. And you go, after all the effort you put in, that's where I'm ending up. So that was really kind of an interesting pivotal moment for me to kind of think about real estate. And then the second thing I was going to share is I also started to think about, are there more people who have kind of felt similar, thought similarly? So I ended up running into somebody who had quit their corporate job and started to do this full time. And her and her husband both had basically become free from a W-2. So that really got things kind of kicked in motion for me to really research and understand what all it takes to first start investing passively, then maybe thinking about investing actively.
Got it. And that shift from kind of the, let me just put my head down and climb the corporate ladder to, okay, I'm going to start investing in real estate. It sounds like you dipped your toe in the water passively, right? So how did you start that? And some people I talk to, they kind of think about real estate in the terms that most people know, and that's single family, right? They can buy a house. They probably live in a house they bought, or they know people obviously that have purchased homes. And so they start single family. Where did you start your journey? And then I've got a couple other follow-on to that.
Yeah, for sure. So I did start my journey. I became that accidental landlord that everybody talks about from 2007-8 timing. So I was that. I did have a townhome. I had moved into another home and I started to invest in that and worked on the tenants that I had. Those are changing every year and a half, working through some of that. So that really kind of shifted my mindset. Like, hey, I've done single family. I was on a phone call with my tenants when I'm in Disney with my kids and really realized, like, is this really something that I want to keep doing? And then fast forward, I'm thinking through my taxes and really figuring out, well, I'm working and making a lot of money, the investment in real estate, but single family, well, that clearly wasn't it. So I actually decided to sell that last year and really think about, hey, is there a better way to invest it? And that's where I really started to research and understand, you know, what other ways to invest into real estate. And multifamily was one of the ones that kind of came up to me.
And so a lot of people I talk to that are kind of starting their journey and people that listen to this podcast, they're maybe in that situation where they're hearing about real estate. Obviously, if they're listening to this, they stumbled upon a real estate focused investing podcast. So how did you get focused on real estate? Because once you start to peel back the onion on alternative investments, and that's what real estate is kind of classified as, how did you kind of narrow down to the multifamily space? And then the obvious follow-on to that is, how did you find people that are doing this and then feel comfortable to put your money with them? Like, that's a big jump to go from, I have a townhome that I'm managing the tenants, and then to go, okay, I'm going to give somebody that maybe you just met or you know through a connection to invest money with. So I'm curious about that.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the things, my background is computer science and mathematics. I do like numbers. So one of the things that I started to do initially moving from townhome to this multifamily is really understanding the returns. And the returns on single family, you have to bring a large amount of down payment. So that's 20%, 30%, yeah, more so in this market right now. That 20 to 30% on a $300,000 to $400,000 house is $60,000 to $80,000. You can't really get that money and say double it as quickly as you can in multifamily. So when I started to see some of the usual returns that are there for multifamily, I think that was just a fascinating concept. So like, that's where I kind of just started to peel the onion. Like, okay, what are the returns? How much work or effort do I have to put in single family versus how much effort I have to put in multifamily? So I think that was kind of a trigger point as well. And then from there, one of the things is, I think everybody knows in this business, end of the day, it's about the relationships and it's about, do you know the people you know, like, and trust? And can you really work with them to understand if you are here and you want to make this much amount in investment money, you got to know the people in the middle. So thankfully, yeah, I was able to find a few people I knew actually from past who were in corporate America. So I talked to them, understood, asked for their help, like, what conferences are they going to? What books are they reading? What podcasts are they listening to? And with the basically combination of those three things, I was able to kind of pull information together. And from that, started to do my passive investing, researching on some sponsors, and then moving into active earlier this year.
Got it. Well, I want to kind of dig into that a little bit more around the first kind of passive investment, because I think that's always a interesting and somewhat scary moment to wire money to somebody that can essentially hold it for a handful of years and hopefully return with friends. So, but before we jump into that piece, I want to take a quick sponsor break. So we'll be right back.
Whether you're trying to hire a full-time employee or a contractor to fill a gap, Hire Tomorrow can help. Hire Tomorrow is a boutique recruitment firm that has successfully filled sales and marketing, human resources, and technology positions with companies ranging from startups to Fortune 500. If you're struggling to find the right talent, check out hiretomorrow.com or reach out to recruiting at hiretomorrow.com to see how they can help.
We are back on the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast with Divya Smith. So we're up to the point where you're kind of starting to your passive investing journey into multifamily. You kind of selected this asset based on the potentially better returns than you were going to be able to get in the single family world that you had started in. So it sounds like you had a good kind of group of people that you were able to lean on and learn from, right? And maybe kind of avoid some of the initial pitfalls and mistakes that maybe they made. So that's always a great way to kind of follow the lead of people that have blazed a trail before you. And so you're at the point now where you're kind of starting your path of investment. So like I said before the break, like walk me through that first investment. Where was it? And how did you get to the point where you felt comfortable with wiring anywhere from, you know, typically these syndications are $50,000 to $100,000 minimums. So how did you get to the point where that was something you felt comfortable doing?
Yeah. So two or three pieces to that. So the first one, you know, starting out thinking about what are the other alternative options for investment? I think that was the first one, right? So really kind of thinking through those. And as I thought about it, I didn't know a whole lot about precious metals. And I think the prices were too high. So I started to look into them. I looked into potentially different ways of investing in stocks. But then I realized most of my 401k and everything so far I had invested was already in stocks. So I'm truly not diversifying.
Yeah.
And then finally kind of started to say, okay, I'm not really invested in real estate. So let's kind of do some more research to understand what kind of returns I can get in real estate and really diversify on that end. So with that, that's kind of kickstart my journey towards real estate. Now, specifically thinking about passive investing with somebody, that did take me, honestly, a few months of time.
Yeah.
And end of the day, whether you know your sponsors or not, it is important to kind of take that time to get on a phone call with them. Is it a similar personality match? I actually like to call it, is it a value match? Because end of the day, are values similar? Like, are we trying to achieve the same things, similar things, but also with same values? We
yeah.
all are looking, you know, to make extra money. I don't think anybody denies that. We all are trying to do that. But do we all go about it the same way? So for me, kind of meeting with my sponsors at that time who were presenting a deal, I wasn't able to kind of do the first deal that they had initially put in front of me, but kind of planning for it, like, this is what I want to do. But then also kind of vetting them along the way. So what's been their background? How many deals have they been part of? Kind of really understanding what's their kind of backstory and why did they get into it? Is it a personality and a value match? So kind of did all that. Of course, that first time you do any deal, that's the hardest. And funny enough, that was the smallest amount I invested in. After that, I always invested kind of more money than the first deal. Yeah. But got started on that. And that really helped me kind of think through, okay, what are now the new things I need to think about from an investor standpoint?
Yeah, and I think especially like now as we're recording this in mid-September 2023, so we're in this unique kind of cycle where we've got really high interest rates. There's some still a bit of a delta in the what asking prices are and what reality is for a lot of the value add deals that are out there in the market. And so I guess one of the big things that I think about now is how to vet a sponsor, right? Or a capital raiser, whoever is bringing you that deal, whether they're the person that found it or they know the operator that found it. So you mentioned a couple of things that you kind of talk about with your values match. If somebody's listening to this and they're like, I want to get involved, but maybe they have some uncertainty around where we are in this economic cycle. And there are a lot of headlines out there about multifamilies going to zero and, you know, all this doomsday stuff, which I don't believe in. But how do you think is a good way for somebody to really start that vetting process to do as much of their due diligence as possible on the person that's bringing them the deal? Because that's kind of who you're betting on, right? The deal is the deal and nobody's going to bring you a crap deal, right? Like they're always going to bring you something that has great returns and there are risks, obviously, and all of this stuff. But yeah, the long-winded answer or question around how do you kind of get comfortable and ask the right questions? And what are some of the questions that you ask that you maybe didn't mention already?
Yeah, so I'll share a few specific questions. And then I actually have like a guide, a free guide on my site for 10 specific questions to ask from investors. So if you or the folks are interested in what types of questions to ask before you invest with anybody to make sure you safeguard your investment, that's on there on the website.
Yeah.
But two or three big things that I look for, one being location. End of the day, real estate is still a lot about location. I think we kind of forget about it, but at the same time, especially in this market, the real estate does appreciate. Anybody now till 20 or 30 years from now, all of that real estate will appreciate. But if it's in a great location, it will appreciate really well. Thinking about that location being kind of important one. Second thing, so my background is all corporate. So for me, every single big project I've done, and I've managed over $50 to $100 million projects, sometimes larger, almost always for every single project, one of the big things we talk about is risk mitigation and risk mitigation strategies. Yep. So just sitting down and thinking about, okay, if you were to invest in this specific deal, what are the risks associated with it? And really like asking your sponsor team, like, have they thought about the risks related to that? So specifically interest rate being high. Well, how are you mitigating the interest rate? Okay. Are you buying a rate cap for how long? Okay. Is your underwriting based on those interest rates and rate cap? Like, let's say you're hitting the ceiling on those rates. Can you still make all the bills and can you still have a cash flowing deal?
Right.
So those being like two, three important ones to kind of think about right off the bat. And then one thing that some of the folks kind of forget about at times is really look at the experience of the entire sponsorship team. One of the things, and you probably can attest to that, is there's lots of pieces. When we are bringing together these deals, there's lots of pieces to it. So just one person's experience is not enough. You really do have to look at holistically what that sponsorship team's entire experience looks like. So those are, I would say, three big nuggets I would look at.
Yeah, one thing I definitely start to, when I look at deals that I'm either going to bring to my investors or that I may passively invest in myself, you really want to know who the asset manager is and know what their background is. Because we're seeing right now that if you bought a deal in 2019 or 2020, you could have sold it in 21, 22 and made a lot of money and you looked like a genius, even though you may not have been a great operator. And we're seeing now that especially the value add bridge loan, variable rate debt deals are struggling in a lot of instances. And it comes down to who is the operator, who is the asset manager that is actually keeping the property management team, the on-site team up to date, making sure they're doing the things they need to do. So I really doubling down on making sure that the asset management function of a deal is strong and they have experience, and it all comes back down to track record and all of that stuff. So
yeah, absolutely. As an investor, it's very difficult for investors to know what type of questions to ask for my asset manager. Couldn't agree more. But even just a basic question, as you just mentioned, hey, did you actually update the property? Did you actually get higher rents than predicted? And just some of those basic things, because there's quite a few folks, to your point, purchased a property, didn't really do many updates, and then were able to turn around and sell it for profit only because the market was kind of increasing at a fast speed and they could just get profits out of it without really doing anything.
That's right. So we talk about a lot about your passive side, and I'm very always fascinated about that because that's how we started. After we bought our duplex, we were like, okay, well, we're going to try this multifamily thing out. I want to know how the deal works from a passive investor side so that I know when I bring a deal to an investor, they kind of know what to expect and I can explain it to them. At what point did you shift over to being active? And let's talk about that first deal. To your point you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of ways to get involved as an active investor, finding the deal, raising money for the deal, asset managing the deal, all that other fun stuff. So let's talk about that first one and what role or roles did you take on in that first one?
Sounds good. So the first deal specifically, I've taken on the role of investor relations. So not only do I look at kind of the big picture, and it really does fit into my personality. So having been the corporate executive for a while, I can kind of take a big picture of and understand kind of where all the KPIs are, pull them all together and really provide that big picture of here's where we are, here's where we need to be, and kind of having that broader perspective. So capital raising is part of kind of every single person's role anyway. So it's the investor relations, really making sure, are we able to communicate the things the right way and really be honest and open about how the property is doing. So that's my role. And having kind of been in that space, I looked at all the different roles. And at some point in time, Justin, you probably do the same thing, is you start out with one role, but you have to slowly but surely continue to like learn and expand into further roles. So that's kind of where I'm at. Started with investor relations and continue to expand my role further.
Got it. So what was the first deal that you were kind of investor relations on? Where was it? Maybe give us at least a little some high level on what was the business plan and all that.
Yeah, sure. So the first deal was in Dallas. It's 150 units. It was a deal, a Class B property. My focus tends to be Class B specifically because we can kind of take in, make updates and really, of course, appreciate the value of the building. Yes. So we started with that. We acquired that in March. Our goal is do value adds to it. One of the things that is difficult at this time, there are quite a few renters that we came across who were delinquent. So we're kind of cleaning the house at this one at a time. To your point, you know, having a very strong asset management team is important. In addition to that, also having a right property management team to kind of work through that. So it's all coming down, making sure, are we taking actions fast enough to make the property profitable quickly and then continue to have it cash flow.
That's awesome. So Class B, it sounds like it's still a bit of a value add play, right? How did you structure the debt? Is it bridge? Is it fixed rate? Did you assume the loan? I've seen a lot of loan assumptions out there, which can be a really good way to get into a loan that's already existing that is at a much lower rate than you can get right now. So obviously, I'm just kind of curious, kind of took one down earlier this year.
Yeah, for sure. So we did a fixed rate, or I should say we did a variable rate with a rate cap, which basically has become a fixed rate at the time because it continues to hit that ceiling. So it's at 5.75% interest rate. So we continue to see that. Now it's still decent interest rate. And thankfully, we were able to lock in a cap rate that was low enough at that time. It's much higher even than it was 6 months ago. So we were able to kind of do it that way. We didn't do any preferred debt partners. We only did preferred equity investors. So we kind of stuck with that model.
And for people that are on the podcast listening to this, like rate caps, how do they work? And what's the benefit of getting them? And they're not free, right? You've got to pay for them and buy them. So how do they work?
Yeah, so just a high level, it's basically a ceiling for the interest rate. So a rate cap would be, let's say the interest rate you may be getting today is 4.5%, but it's a variable interest rate. And if it goes beyond, say, 5.5%, you purchase a rate cap at 5.5%, and let's say you pay for a certain amount for it. It can range anywhere from $350,000, which is what kind of rates were a couple of years ago for a couple of years. And now it's almost up to $1 million, $1.5 million, depending on, again, location, how big the property is, how big the risk is. So end of the day, it's basically a risk mitigation strategy so that you are not paying more than you can afford to pay for interest rate, because you don't want all your money to basically end up going to the bank just paying for the property.
Right. Because if you don't buy the rate cap, then if you buy it at 5 and it goes to 8, even if you bought it in 21, you're probably at like 3, 3.5, maybe even lower. And then they go to 8 and then you're like, well, wait, I still have to pay all of the interest, right? Your interest payment increases dramatically. So it's almost like insurance. So if it won't go above a certain amount, so you can predict kind of, okay, maximum debt payment that we're going to need to pay is X. And we can build that into our model to say, okay, even if it does hit the max, we know that we can still make the payment, operate the property, do the renovations and all that fun stuff. That makes a lot of sense. Overall market now is a little interesting. It sounds like you are still active, obviously taking down a deal earlier this year. I guess, what is your sentiment on where the rest of 2023 is going to go, 2024? It sounds like you're still in buy mode. Talk me through that. I'm kind of curious.
Yeah. So one of the things that I wish I was on the other side of the coin when this happened in 2007-08 was ability to purchase. And we are starting to see more of that later this year and probably early into next year is the interest rates are not going to go down. So any of those syndications that were not as experienced, didn't maybe buy rate cap, maybe have rate caps that are expiring in next year, some of those properties will need to sell. So we actually were able to acquire one of those properties recently that I'm working on right now. And we were able to get a really good deal because they weren't able to pay their debt service. So we are able to kind of acquire that and being really smart about now that we know what the situation is, can we plan for the worst case and really make sure the deal works out? It's in a good location with good neighborhood. It is Class B, can do value add in those properties. So really thinking through that. So that's kind of where my thought process is. There's not as many deals on the market as there were last year and the year before. Absolutely. I think everybody gets it. But I think this is where just being extra cautious about, are the numbers working? End of the day, my favorite thing is math has to just work out. If the math doesn't work out, you can't really make up numbers, right? So math tells the story and you'll be able to kind of see if it's going to be profitable. Because end of the day, for investors, we need to be able to provide them the returns that we're promising them.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where if this is the kind of a transition of wealth is going to happen because of what's going on in this space. I think I saw or heard that there's like $1 trillion of commercial real estate, not just multifamily, but just commercial real estate in general, debt that's coming due in the next 12 to 18 months or something like that. So to your point, there's a lot of deals that I'm seeing out there with the word distressed actually on the emails and effectively saying, hey, we, the sellers are distressed or the property is distressed and they need to get out of this because they are going to foreclose on the property. And that's not a scenario that they want to have happen, that the investors want to have happen, and they just need to get out of the deal. So I think there could be some opportunity to if you have some dry powder. And people that I talk to that are working at larger funds and institutional buyers, they're kind of waiting for the real blood to hit the water and to really go after some of these distressed assets that were purchased in the last 12 to 18 months. I'm kind of in the same boat. Like, I think there are going to be deals to be had. I think you, to your point, conservative underwriting is the flavor of the month. And I know the word conservative is overused in our industry. Nobody ever is going to send you a deal and says, this is really risky underwriting. But yeah, I think if you can make the math work in this environment, the deal could be theoretically a pretty good home run deal over the long term. So I guess, how long have you been active? Because I think you said you started kind of a year and a half ago passively. The first deal you said you just did in March. So fairly recently, it sounds like.
Fairly recently, yeah. One of the things that you kind of mentioned, so just to kind of talk about the distressed deals. Yeah. One of the things that a lot of my investors are asking currently is, what do you mean by distress? Is the property in bad shape? And like, I just have to remind them, when we say distress, especially in multifamily or a commercial perspective, distress more so means it's probably closer to financial distress, less that the property itself is not in good condition. Because if that was the case, most of your multifamily syndicators and investors would not bring you that deal because we want to buy a decent property. So this specifically, so I am recently kind of doing this as of March. And one of the things that is exciting for me, at least with my background, is I've just had a knack and an ability to find kind of the right sponsors, the right people to work with. And having kind of switched multiple companies has allowed me to kind of sift through, I would say, certain sponsors and kind of their background. One of the things is, can you kind of do the background research? Can you ask them the right questions? Can you really understand what their experience has been to make sure that they'll be good with your money? Because end of the day, you want to hire people who are good with your money and can protect it for longer run.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. And I think the kind of focus that I think, or one of the things I wanted to kind of dig into a little bit is, and you know, you've only been kind of in the active world for a little bit, but have you seen some of the sponsors that you've partnered with, their return metrics, like their return profiles of deals that they're bringing out, changed over the last year or so to be a different kind of return metric, right? Because a lot of people in the value add space 2 years ago were 10, 12% cash on cash return and 2x in 3 years and, you know, all that fun stuff. Like, what are you seeing now? Or have you seen a little bit of a shift in what their appetite is for like a good deal?
Yeah. So the preferred return, you know, to your point, I was seeing last year almost up to 8 to 10, closer to 10%.
Yeah.
I think the more so recent deals, I would say I had seen like the max of 5 to 7%. And it kind of is ranging in that percentage. And then to your question, you know, specifically about how are the metrics changed for all these sponsors that I've been working with? And yes, they have. I think a lot less people last year and the year before were looking at, hey, if we hit that ceiling percentage, the debt service, the rate we are paying, it's going to be maybe for 6 months. I think now I'm seeing more so underwriting. We're assuming the ceiling is going to probably be there for 2 to 3 years, if not longer, you know, majority of the deal timeframe. So I think we set conservative, but I think there's even more conservative to kind of go. The reality is we want to be realistic instead of just being conservative. But in the market and the space we have seen, it's just better to be extremely conservative with the amount of debt you might pay. And then specifically in Texas, we also talk about the high property taxes that we pay. Yeah. So are your sponsors accounting for high insurance cost, high debt service, and then high property taxes? So those are the three type of specific numbers that I end up looking at to make sure, are we matching for those and are those showing increasing over time?
Yeah. And the insurance piece is a crazy one too, depending on where your deals are. I mean, I know that one of the guys I know, he's invested in a deal in Corpus Christi, Texas, and their insurance rate tripled in 1 year. And that's not something that you can opt out of paying, right? Like you've got to pay that. So, I mean, that can crush your cash flow right there if you're assuming $1,000 a month in insurance and it's now three. So that's a real big thing. Speaking of which, what kind of markets are you looking at right now? Because it sounds like your first deal is in Dallas. You live in Dallas, so obviously location for you is perfect. So to the extent that you can or want to go drive by the property and actually kind of be on site, that's a big benefit because, especially as I talk about asset management, you need somebody that has boots on the ground and not just be kind of the reliant on the on-site property management team. Because they're not investors in that deal. They're to do a job and maybe they do it or they don't, right? So what markets are you and your kind of syndicators looking at?
Yeah, so I'm primarily focused on Texas, even more so specifically DFW for now. So I'm just not as aware of in the Houston market. That makes me just a little bit nervous. I think it's just beachside properties right now. One of the metrics that I also look at is kind of the weather patterns. And more so recently in the last couple of years, we have just seen a lot more things happen from a flooding perspective. And that's the reason why Corpus Christi, you know, insurance has gone up. Yeah. Perfect example. So that's kind of why I've kind of stayed away from that at this point in time, unless it's much further inland. And the second thing I look at is also the demographics. So out of most of Texas at this point in time, I think you're starting to see San Antonio and DFW. Those are the two markets that are kind of continue to have a lot more population growth. I think you're starting to mature and see numbers in Austin, which is where you're from. So you probably are starting to see that maturing and similar in Houston too. So kind of San Antonio and DFW, but I'm primarily focused at this time in DFW.
Yeah, I have friends that live in Houston and they look at deals there and I'm always just a little skittish whenever I see hurricanes ripping up in the Gulf and all that stuff. And I like San Antonio. I live in Austin. Austin's a crazy competitive market to be in, especially in the space that we live. And so I would love to find a deal locally, but I think San Antonio and even, you know, I don't know how long you've been in Dallas, but Dallas and Fort Worth used to be separate cities and now they've converged. And the corridor between Austin and San Antonio has started to kind of take that same motion. So New Braunfels and San Marcos are starting to get talked about as if they're a DFW-like model. So brokers will say whatever they need to say to sell a property. So
yes, exactly. I mean, I think the distance between Austin and San Antonio is still about an hour, right?
Yeah, depending on where you are. Yeah, it's about 90 minutes. So.
Yeah. DFW and Dallas and Fort Worth are only about 30 to 40 minutes away from each other. It's almost like Twin Cities. I know. I actually moved from Twin Cities to Minneapolis and St. Paul. Very similar kind of model to like 30 to 40 minutes from both the cities.
Fair enough. So I guess as you kind of think about kind of the rest of this year, it sounds like you're working on a deal now. Kind of what are the things you're kind of really looking at and protecting yourself with as far as like underwriting and where you're looking at deals for the next kind of 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, so I'm going to continue to look for deals primarily in the DFW space. And the three things that I talked about, can we do underwriting specifically based on, let's say we were hitting that debt ceiling every single time for majority of the 5-year time span. So I do underwriting with that. By the end of third to fourth year, I'm almost doubling the property taxes because even if you see 15% increase year over year, you're almost kind of hitting those double numbers by the end of year 4 and 5. And then those insurance costs, I think those are really difficult to predict at times. So kind of getting those numbers from multiple folks, getting a bid on it and really taking the high and the low and just making sure taking a good average number to predict some of those insurance costs as well. So those are three big numbers that are ongoing changing that we really need to kind of stay on top of.
Yeah. No, that's fair. And I think that makes a lot of sense based on where you can get hurt, right, in these deals as far as that goes. So, all right, I want to kind of transition to kind of the end and the kind of final three pack of questions that I ask every guest on the podcast. So first question is, what's one piece of advice that got you started or helped you along your real estate journey?
I think just taking action. At the end of the day, I think we kind of cause ourselves to do analysis paralysis sort of situation. So really take action. And whether that action is just getting educated or, you know, asking somebody if you could even start with a very small investment amount. Some investments will allow you to even invest $25,000.
Yeah.
So kind of just working with your sponsors and saying, you know, really dipping your feet, dip your toes in the water and just see kind of what it feels like.
Yeah, I think it's important too, especially if you know the sponsor or the deal finder or somebody on the team. To your point, sometimes they will let you in, kind of friends and family, if you will. But the other thing is, if you really want to start to learn about this space, asking to kind of peek behind the curtains a little bit as an investor, even if you're a limited partner, to kind of see how they work, especially if you want to do what you did and jump into the active side of the space as well. A lot of people will do that because it's fun to share this information. And that's why I started the podcast and all that fun stuff. So
Yes, awesome. Absolutely. And I think to your point, that's exactly why I have a webinar too. And it's more so educational focused because of those reasons. So many people who don't understand the benefits of investing in real estate, including kind of passive income, cash flow, tax benefits. So kind of sharing all that knowledge is always helpful.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Very cool. All right. Second question. What is your favorite real estate or business book that you're into right now?
So one of the books, I don't know if I would say favorite, but it's very fascinating to me. I'm reading Dive at Zero. So I think it's just such a fascinating book. Dive at Zero.
Okay.
The concept of we save all this money to kind of put it towards our retirement, but we don't spend enough time on our experiences. So how can you kind of like take and really appropriately invest in the right places, but then also use that money for experiences to live your life while you're a little bit younger, not waiting all the way till retirement. So fascinating book. It's very, very interesting.
Yeah, I saw Die With Zero. I saw that book probably on Instagram someplace. But yeah, that's interesting. I'll have to check it out. Sure. All right, yeah. Final question. If you hit your financial freedom number, meaning you could live an amazing life just off of the passive income from your investments, what would you do?
I'm already starting to do some of that. I'm able to hit about 40 to 50% of that number, which has been helpful, but I still love technology. So I've been consulting on side. For me, that's really fun. The other thing I'm also doing is kind of helping younger professionals kind of in their career to be able to move along. So Women in tech. So I'm involved in a women in tech group. I'm also involved in some of the more business groups around town. So that's kind of what I do. Kind of on more fun side, I think I'd probably visit a lot of national parks. So I love hiking. Cool. I am very much into CrossFit. So more kind of physical activity. So probably kind of balance the two out.
Awesome. Well, you'll have a lot more time to travel in CrossFit and help women in tech. And so that'll be a lot of fun. So awesome. Well, Divya, it's been awesome to have you on the podcast. I really appreciate all your time. How can people find out about you, learn about you? It sounds like you've got a webinar podcast yourself. So yeah, plug away.
Yeah, sure. So you can reach out to me through my company, ascendingavenue.com, and feel free to sign up there for the mailing list. Also, as I mentioned, there is a free guide for you, you know, which has what are the top 10 questions to ask before you invest and to protect your investment. And then I'm available on LinkedIn, on Instagram, and on Facebook. So all those channels.
Awesome. We'll put a lot of this in the show notes. So Divya, I really appreciate you taking some time and chatting today.
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you, Justin. Thanks for having me.
I hope you got value out of this episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast, your one-stop shop for education on how you can continue to work hard in your career and have different options to invest even harder. If you took anything away from this episode, please like and comment. I read every comment as it helps me serve you better. Make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way, you won't miss out on more valuable content. If you're watching this video, it means that you want to grow your passive real estate portfolio. The easiest way to do that is to join our investor club by heading to greatventurecapital.com/invest. The link is in the show notes. See you on the next episode.